TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Norman Finkelstein, Beyond Chutzpah. Even though Professor Norman Finkelstein received high praise for his most recent book from respected authors and journalists, such as Noam Chomsky and Amy Goodman, Beyond Chutzpah has been ignored by the media in the U.S., and it's very hard to find in bookstores. Finkelstein takes on the most taboo question in the U.S., the relationship of Israel to the Palestinians. In part one of this talk, he spoke about the withdrawal from Gaza and the building of the wall. In this part, he takes up the most terrible question of all. Did the Israelis commit an act of ethnic cleansing when in 1948 they removed 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and villages to make room for the new state of Israel? Listeners who may find this a shocking topic need to consider that the minimal U.S. media coverage of actions by the State of Israel against Palestinians, while reporting in detail on actions of Palestinians against Israel, is unique. All this is hotly debated in the European, Middle Eastern, and even the Israeli media. Here is Norman Finkelstein, assistant professor of political science, speaking on his most recent book, Beyond Chutzpah.
How did the Palestinians become refugees in 1948? Always a standard topic of inquiry. An Israeli scholar named Benny Morris, he said, basically they became refugees because of the war situation. His famous formulation was, the Palestinian refugees question was born of war, it wasn't by design. Not by design, it wasn't intentional. There are other scholars who say, not true, it was intentional. It was premeditated that from fairly early on, the Zionists intended to expel the indigenous population because except by expelling them, you simply couldn't create a Jewish state in an area which was overwhelmingly not Jewish. So it is true that some controversy remains. Those who claim the Palestinians were premeditatedly expelled, and those who claim they were victims of a war. However, that's a fairly narrow range of difference, because whether you read a Benny Morris, or you read a Nirma Sala, or an Ilan Pepe, they all agree, they all use the same expression, they all agree it was an ethnic cleansing in 1948. On that point, there is a solid consensus in the scholarship. What caused the ethnic cleansing? Yes, there's differences. But the whole Israeli, I hate the postmodern language, but the whole Israeli narrative has just dropped off the spectrum of scholarly discussion of the topic. There is discussion, but still quite narrow. If we now turn not to scholarship, but we turn to the human rights question, that is to say, what's going on now in the occupied territories? Here we can talk about a consensus, full stop, no qualifications, no caveats. In preparation for the book which the University of California Press just published, I went through literally thousands of pages of human rights reports on the Israel-Palestine conflict. It happens that Israel and Palestine are among the most closely, or at any rate, voluminously documented areas in the world. So you have the reports of Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Those are the human rights organizations with a global mandate. And then you have the local organizations, B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, Piketty, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, Physicians for Human Rights in Israel, lots and lots of organizations. A large part of human rights work is dependent on documenting incidents. So typically, if you're a human rights field worker, what you have to do is you go to a demonstration. You see the Palestinian demonstrators here, the Israeli army here. You have to see who provoked whom first. What was the nature of the provocation? Did the nature of the provocation warrant this kind of response? When the Israelis responded, did they aim at the feet? Did they aim at the waist? Did they aim at the head? Among the Palestinians, were there armed persons among the demonstrators? And if there were, where were they situated? You would expect, with so many different people watching the same incident, so many different human rights organizations watching the same incident, you would expect a lot of disagreement. And one of the true surprises for me, in fact, it was a kind of enigma for me, was that when I went through the thousands of pages of human rights reports over the past 20 years, the human rights organizations didn't disagree about anything. Not on questions of fact, not on questions of law, not on questions of detail. Over a 20-year period, I was only able to detect one incident at one demonstration where the human rights organizations, two of them, disagreed about what happened. I was really, truly surprised by that, because you would think, watching or listening to the media, that there's lots of disagreement about what's going on regarding human rights in the occupied territories. But when you turn to the actual human rights organizations, there's none, except for one incident. And that points to then the main burden of my evening's remarks. If what I'm saying is true, that among mainstream human rights organizations, among mainstream scholars, among mainstream authoritative bodies, there is next to no disagreement about the Israel-Palestine conflict, how do we account for all the passionate, vehement controversy on that topic in public life in the United States? And my suggestion would be, as they call it, my thesis, is that there are two kinds of disagreement on the Israel-Palestine conflict. One which I would call legitimate disagreement, honest people disagreeing, and the other I would call contrived or fabricated disagreement. Let me begin with the easier part, the legitimate disagreement. Under that rubric, I would include, for example, people can agree on the facts of a particular event, but disagree on the moral conclusions to be drawn from it. The moral conclusions don't follow from the facts. Let's take a concrete example. We'll return to those Palestinian refugees. You can agree that the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948, but disagree about whether or not it was a good thing. So if you take the historian Benny Morris, He doesn't dispute, and he freely uses the expression that Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948. But, he says, I think it was a good thing. Just as he says, and I'm using his words, I think the annihilation of the Native Americans in North America was a good thing. Absent the annihilation, you couldn't have built this great American Republic. And similarly, he says, in fact, factually correctly, he says, absent the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, you could not have created a Jewish state, which he takes to be a higher good. You couldn't have been able to create a Jewish state in Palestine. That's a different moral judgment. No dispute about the facts. Or if you take the case of Professor Dershowitz in his 1991 quote-unquote autobiography, we have to always qualify everything with quote-unquote when it comes to Professor Dershowitz. In his autobiography, he discusses the issue of ethnic cleansing, and he says that, in my opinion, ethnic cleansing is, quote, a fifth-rate moral issue akin to, or in his words, analogous to massive urban renewal. So he doesn't dispute the ethnic cleansing. He just thinks that morally it's a trivial issue. Well, now returning to the moral universe of normal human beings, you could still agree on the facts, agree on the moral side of the question, but disagree on your political conclusions. Now that seems a little bit complicated. How can that be? Well, let's look at those Palestinian refugees again. If you're a Professor Chomsky, he'll say, of course, factually, the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948. Morally, it was an abomination. Legally, of course, the Palestinians have the right to return. I might mention parenthetically that even the question of the right of the return of Palestinians, among human rights organizations, it's not controversial. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, in 2000, the year 2000, they issued statements saying, of course, Palestinians have the right to return to Israel. It's not controversial. But then Professor Chomsky will say, politically, even though factually they were ethnically cleansed, morally it was an abomination, legally they have the right to return, politically, he says, I don't think it's feasible. I don't think it's going to happen. In fact, he says, I think it's immoral to wave in front of Palestinians in refugee camps the prospect of their return when you know and I know they're not going back to Israel. Now, that's a political judgment. And just what it says, it's a judgment. You weigh a multiplicity of factors, and in your weighing, this is the likely outcome and not that one. In my opinion, honest people can disagree about that question. It doesn't make anyone an enemy. It's simply a legitimate difference based on a legitimate weighing of the multiplicity of factors. Having said that, pointed to, in my opinion, the existence of legitimate disagreements, it's important to emphasize that the area of legitimate disagreement is very small compared to the range of agreement on the Israel-Palestine conflict, political agreement. There is a vote on the two-state settlement, and the vote is 151-3. the whole world. On one side, Israel, the United States, and the island state of Dominica on the other side. That's it. People often ask, why Dominica? And I often respond, that's all that the dollar could buy back then. It was very weak. Now, if you fast forward 15 years, you go to 2004, 2003. In fact, the world dramatically changes during that 15-year period. As we all know, some lament, some do not, an entire social system, the Soviet-type system, disappeared from the map. So there was a profound political change, and there was also a profound geographic change. Namely, if in 1989 there were 154 member states of the UN, now there are 191. 40 new nation states came into existence in the last 15 years. What makes that an interesting fact is that at the political level, there's relatively little disagreement. So where does all the controversy come from? And my argument is that most of the controversy is contrived. It's fabricated. To put it simply, it's fake. It has nothing to do with the real world. Its purpose and aim is to deflect attention from the facts bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict. The first kind of fabricated or contrived controversy is the claim that the Israel-Palestine conflict is so complicated, this effort to wrap the conflict in this mist of complexity, this mystification. So we're told that the Israel-Palestine conflict is about a cosmic clash of religions, or a cosmic clash of civilizations, or it goes back to biblical enmities and hatreds. And we're also always told that it's unique. The fancy Latin term is it's sui generis. You can't compare it to any other conflict. The purpose of these claims is pretty straightforward. Because A, if it's so complicated, then maybe your commonsensical notions of right and wrong don't apply here. They kept saying, what's going on in Palestine is obvious. It's perfectly obvious what's happening. They keep saying, obvious, obviously, obvious. What's happening? These Palestinian Arabs, they see all of their neighbors, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, they're all gaining independence, or like Transjordan, they're on their way to independence. The only one who's being denied national self-determination are the Palestinian Arabs. And they think it's unfair. And not only is it unfair, but they're concerned that all these Jews are coming in saying they're going to create a Jewish state, and they're worried what's going to happen to them if a Jewish state is created. It wasn't complicated. They kept saying it's obvious. Incidentally, they kept saying it was obvious that it has nothing to do with racial enmity or religion. They were very emphatic about that. Or turn to Benny Morris, the mainstream Israeli historian on the Israel-Palestine conflict. He's written this thick, comprehensive history of the conflict called Righteous Victims. And at one point in his book, he writes, the fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. The fear of territorial displacement and dispossession was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. Now, some of you are wondering, well, what's so profound about that statement, and why repeat it? But actually, when I came across it, the words, as it were, leapt off the page for me. Why? Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism was anti-Semitism. He doesn't say it was hatred of Jews. He doesn't say it was because they were bringing over Enlightenment values and they wanted to emancipate women. No. It had nothing to do with that. The reason was perfectly straightforward. They feared that they were going to be dispossessed and displaced. Very uncomplicated. That's why they were resisting. As it turned out, the fear was very rational. Imagine in any other context, if the kinds of exotic explanations were invoked, as are typically invoked in the Israel-Palestine conflict, and they would be greeted, they would be received with ridicule. So, for example, take the Native Americans. Their resistance to European encroachment, Euro-American encroachment, was very bloody. No point in making this politically correct image that it was, you know, Joan Baez singing Kumbaya. No. They killed men, they killed women, they killed children. It was a very bloody affair, as it was on the side of the settlers who were displacing them. But imagine what reception a historian would be given if he or she were to say that the chief motor of Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment was anti-whiteism or anti-Europeanism or anti-Christianism. You know, people would laugh. Why do you have to make recourse to these exotic explanations when the obvious explanation also happens to be a sufficient one? The Native Americans were resisting because, to paraphrase Benny Morris, they feared territorial dispossession and displacement. The second kind of contrived or fabricated form of controversy about the Israel-Palestine conflict is to drag in utterly irrelevant historical events to deflect attention from the conflict itself. And the most obvious example is the dragging in of the Nazi Holocaust and using that as an argument and a way of deflecting attention from the Israel-Palestine conflict. It's a complicated question, which time doesn't allow me to go into now. Suffice to say that the most important innovation of the Holocaust industry was to impose the idea on the greater public that the Nazi Holocaust was a unique example of suffering in human history. And the claim of uniqueness was then used as a pretext for giving Israel unique moral entitlements. The argument being, if Jews suffered uniquely, and you can't apply the ordinary, normal, moral standards to Jews. So if Israel systematically tortures Palestinian detainees, as it did from 1967 through 1999, according to Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees were tortured during that period. Well, yes, torture is wrong, but remember the Holocaust. And if Israel is the only country in the world which uses house demolitions as a legal form of punishment, yes, that sounds bad, but remember, Jews suffered uniquely in the Nazi Holocaust. So always this argument of the unique suffering was used in order to extenuate Israel's moral abominations in the occupied territories. Up until the late 1980s, no human rights organization, including Amnesty, would directly indict Israel on the question of torture, even though now Amnesty readily acknowledges that from right after the occupation in 67 to the present, Israel has been routinely has been routinely torturing Palestinian detainees. It was very hard to find documentation of that until fairly recently. And now we have a huge amount of documentation showing unequivocally, irrefutably, that truth is on our side and justice is on our side. And I think everyone here in particular will agree that the weapons of truth and justice are, if we learn how to wield them, they are formidable weapons if we learn how to use them. And I think the good news is the, so to speak, weaponry is out there. Now let's learn how to use it. And if we do, even in my most despairing moments, I still remain optimistic that if we learn how to use those weapons, which are fortunate for us, they are readily available. If we learn how to use the weapons, I remain optimistic that we can yet win and bring about a just and lasting resolution of the conflict. Thank you.
That was Norman Finkelstein, assistant professor of political science at DePaul University. He spoke about his most recent book, Beyond Chutzpah. He was recorded by Voices of the Middle East in Berkeley, California, October 2005. This was the last part of a one-hour talk. You can find more information on Norman Finkelstein on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.